doesn't that computer know who you
don't
are?
Don't they have any idea?
Bow down to the Tech Talk host.
That's right. That's right. That's right.
Behold the glory that is me.
A little while ago, I was installing some software, and I ran across this exact same
thing. I find you pompous, judgmental, and completely self-absorbed. Would you be my friend?
Onto a Windows Vista machine.
You would think.
You'd think there'd be no problem.
How could there be a problem with that?
I'd say in a given week, I probably only do about 15 minutes of real, actual work.
Directory permissions with config.msi directory, blah, 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 blah.
This is Tech Talk.
Good morning. This is Tech Talk. We got Dave Sparky Saganaki on the line with us already, I think.
What? This is Tech Talk. I was wondering what this is.
Oh, yeah. Oh, sorry, wrong number. Yeah. I'd like the pepperoni with double cheese.
Oh, my God.
Oh, man.
That sounds great. How about anchovies? You want anchovies on it?
You know, I am one of those guys that that does like a couple anchovies on his pizza every once in a while. So, load it up. Actually, you do a – never mind. I'm going to get into pizza choices and feta and stuff like that because I like my pizza maybe a little different than others. And Dave, we've got a great show today, though. I'm really excited about this. We're going to have not only – Jay Garman hopefully coming on and joining us in just a little bit and answering some Zelda questions, which is always fun. But I also, too, have Alexander Montague on in just a little bit. He's an intellectual property lawyer, one of the top lawyers actually in the country for intellectual property and other concerns related. But he's going to come on today and talk to us about privacy, data privacy, our personal privacy, our online privacy, and we spent a couple minutes talking about it just before the show. It's going to be fascinating, talking everything from Snowden to the NSA and all that, but also to Google and what rights we have to our data on Google. I'm excited. I think it's going to be a good conversation.
That sounds fantastic. I can't wait to hear him.
Yeah.
Can't wait to hear him. Sounds like another wonderful show. Find out.
There you go. Well, I don't know how we do it, but somehow every week we wind up convincing somebody interesting and smart to come on our show.
Well, they're not that smart. If they come on the show, they can't be that smart.
That's a good point. That's a good point. I don't know. You're casting aspersions on our guests here, Dave.
I mean it good-naturedly.
Yes, so. Absolutely.
And what a great name. What a great name for an intellectual property rights lawyer, Alexander Montague. It sounds like... just the name alone commands respect, and we'll have to try and give him some.
Absolutely. Well, in fact, I joke with him a little bit is that his namesake is a disgraced royal from somewhere in Europe. I can't remember exactly. So you have to be careful when you Google his name that you don't think that you're reading about him and actually reading about this just really dreadfully awful person who.
Way to butter up the guest, Michael.
Yeah, exactly. I just want to make sure. You know, we're going to talk about Google and privacy, and I'll bring that up with them and ask them. You know, because I think that's gonna come up. You know, this has been a big week though too in general tech news. From LinkedIn giving us finally the ability to block members on there. To Microsoft dropping the price of their operating system. We've got Facebook putting out $20 billion for this WhatsApp application and messaging thing. I know I saw you putting up a number of links to articles and things that you found of interest this last week, Dave. So you seem to have dived at least feet first, if not head first, back into the social networking waters again, too.
I've been playing around. Well, you know, I've always had a bit of a problem with social media. It's you got to be a bit self-indulgent to really get into it. And but lately, I was like, well, wait a minute. You watch the dialogue flow by. Everybody's talking about their concerns, and I was like, well, wait a minute. I have some interests. Maybe I'll chime in and see how that feels. So I'm kind of venturing out a little bit more. I changed my picture on Facebook, mm-hmm. and I've gotten a lot of likes. That was kind of interesting. I've been kind of a wallflower. I've been a Facebook wallflower. Now I'm and emerging a little bit.
It's nice to see, Dave. It really is. I think there's a lot of people though that are very much in your the way that they deal with social networking is very much like that, that they don't necessarily want to get involved, but they do enjoy watching things float by. Mm-hmm. And that's a good way to kind of jump in, I think. A lot of people do use and abuse the social networks, and that really informed Facebook's decision to purchase the WhatsApp, I don't even know how you pronounce this, WhatsApp, I guess, company.
What's that? What's that? Like the old Budweiser company. What's that?
Exactly. No, I think that's how you pronounce it.
But it's a company, can you explain to our listeners, $20 billion for a company with 55 employees. How the heck does that happen?
it's kind of similar to the reasons why Facebook itself was valued so incredibly highly in Twitter as well. It's not about anymore the bricks and mortar and the corporate investments and how many servers and whatever else they've got. It really is back and comes down to the users and the number of users. And supposedly this WhatsApp has got a huge number of highly invested users in the service. In fact, what it is, the application itself, from what I understand, is rather than being like a Facebook or a Twitter where you're throwing up information and news and things on a big giant social board that people can comment and like and do whatever they want to with it, it's very focused. It takes information from your contact list, from your phone contacts, from your Gmail contacts, whatever, and you create your groupings and your message distribution around that. So it's a shrinking, really, of that broadcast. And this is apparently what people are looking to do. So they have a huge number of users, and Facebook sees a huge amount of potential in this funneling and this bringing down of the contact, making contact more intimate. I don't know if they're right or not. I like the sound of it and the idea of it, but I don't know if it's true. I don't know if people do want to bring that conversation to a more intimate level, or if what we are really looking for is our 15 minutes of fame that were promised us by Mr. Warhol, you know?
Well, from what I understand, the international market has a lot to do with this as well, right? This is there are 400 million users, right? Isn't that another big factor?
Is that the number? I couldn't find the number. That doesn't surprise me. But it's not only the number of users. So there's that many users, 4 million users. But also too, the average number of texts sent out by these users is 1,200 a month. 1,200 text a month times this number of users. That's insane. That's ridiculous. So, you think about how many times do you go on Facebook and post something? How often would you have to do that to come even close to 1,200 Facebook postings per month? It's outrageous.
Yeah, and certainly the demographics there would probably be the kind of customers you'd want. Young people making texting that much. That's got to be people that are a little younger and in acquisition mode. Needing cars and houses and mm-hmm. electronics and all those kinds of things that you'd want to advertise.
Oh yeah. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think it's it's going to be interesting to see. Now, I just pulled up a little breakdown on the comparison of prices, and this is on TechCrunch. So originally in 2011, it raised about $8 million when it went public, WhatsApp did. So they just said, since then it's gone to almost $20 billion since that point. So this $20 billion, what is that equivalent to? That's four times the market cap of BlackBerry. It's nearly a third of the market cap of Ford Motor Company.
Wow.
And equal to or slightly more than both the Gap and Sony. It's worth 7.5 Mark Cubans, which,
Okay. That's great. And I heard the question asked if WhatsApp's worth $20 billion, what's BlackBerry Messenger worth? That's also got a large user base and has a similar type of it's a similar type of service. So anyway, so Microsoft, that's right. Microsoft has cut its licensing fee for low priced devices. Mm-hmm. Instead of, it was about $50, they were charging about $50 per device to install Windows 8.1, and now they've lowered it to compete with Chromebooks to about $15 per device.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Exactly. Exactly. So I mean, you know, and that's a 70% cut. It does not mean that Windows devices are going to be 70% cheaper, but it should at least reduce it a bit. I mean, that's one of the problems I think with the penetration of Surface is that it just hasn't been cheap enough for people to pick it up. It seems that there's a certain price point where individuals are willing to kind of take a dash at it, you know, and take a chance on it. The Chromebooks and the Google Android devices, they're cheap, man. You look at them and you think, hey, yeah, a Google Chromebook now, I can get that for less than what it would cost me to get an iPad. Why would I not at least try it? You know, if I wanted to do more typing and useful stuff like that. And there's more and more applications that are coming along that are valuable and useful. You know, the big thing against Chromebooks had been that, oh, you got to have Wi-Fi or you can't do anything. That's not really so true anymore. They're building them with more storage space. You can throw a flash drive on them. You can download apps and you can use things offline that you may not realize. And so, for most usage, maybe a cheap Chromebook is not bad. Windows wants to compete with that. I don't know. Do you think this will make a difference, Dave? Do you think that this is going to change things enough?
I hope it does. I hope it does, simply because 8.1 is pretty good. I think it's a pretty good operating system. It deserves a chance. It deserves a shot. Mm-hmm. And Microsoft's trying to innovate anyway. And I think they should, and doing a fair job. Is it as seamless as iOS? No, but it's getting up there. So, and also, speaking of Google and Microsoft, I guess there was a plan in the works for Asus to build a dual boot system that with 8.1 and Android.
Yes.
We're going to do both Android and Windows 8.1. Mm-hmm. And that's been shot down. There were a couple of Samsung had a plan, Asus had a plan, and now suddenly everybody's silent about it. And the rumor is that Google kind of shut it down. Because now processors, Intel's coming out with processors that can run both operating systems. And it would have been great for the end user, I think, but proprietary concerns prevent it, I think.
I think you got a point. I would hope that it makes a difference too, when we start seeing more. Hey, you know, I need to bring our good friend Mr. Garman in here as well. See if we can pull him in with us to talk about that. I want to mention to people though before we switch over there is that tomorrow, Sunday. Hey, Mr. Garman, I'll talk about that later. Hey, how you doing, sir? I think we got everybody on here. Can you hear us?
I can, although who's everybody? Because, you know, you're sort of culling an army these days, aren't you?
We got me, Dave. Hi, Dave. You. That's pretty close. Actually, we're going to have quite a few people, I think, if we and when we come down for conglomeration here in a month or so. I've got a tentative confirmation that actually one of my close friends from high school is going to come out from the East Coast and hang out with us. So, I think we're going to have fun and conglomeration. Every time I look on the website or get a notice from the Facebook feed, they've added yet another new and interesting and exciting guest that they're going to have. David Drake, I saw just recently, is going to be added to the roles there in conglomeration. And it was just there was another one I don't remember off the top of my head that they're building out there. So I'm thrilled. Dave, are you confirmed? Are you definitely coming down with us yet, or are you not sure yet?
I'm in the 75% range.
Okay.
I don't want to make it easy for you guys. I want the anticipation to build.
You're like my family. My whole family is like this. You know, it's like, hey, you gonna commit? You gonna do it? No, what? And my dad's like, I don't like to commit to anything. You know. Well, hopefully. Now, what's the dates again, Jay? It's April 14 to 17, I think, something like that.
11th to the 13th. It's a Friday, Saturday, Sunday. The second weekend in April.
Fantastic. So anybody that is interested in this at all should go to conglomeration.info and sign up. It's a fan-run, fan-focused sci-fi, fantasy, cosplay. It's going to be a blast. I can't wait to get down there. And we're fortunate enough to have Jay Garman here as one of the organizers, and so he's given us a free run of the place. I'm putting words in his mouth. So...
they're not inaccurate. Like, we don't have like an elaborate security force that's gonna like mind you the whole time. It's sort of like, what room do we go in? I think our name's on this door. All right, we'll do a podcast in here. That's fine. No one's apparently using it. That'll work fine.
Excellent. I negotiated with Verizon. I explained to them that that we may or may not have some difficulty with the wired internet there and Ethernet down there. And so I reached out to our good friends at Verizon, and they stepped up to the plate. They're not going to quote unquote sponsor us, but they're going to make sure that we are set up with a MiFi or some other way of getting internet connection while we're down there. And they said that our friend that we like there is Rebecca. She's going to set us up with some cool gadgets that we can have fun with and show off. So I'm going to give a shout out to Verizon, who's going to help us make sure that everything goes off without a hitch down there, and it couldn't be more excited. I've got to keep us on a fairly tight schedule here today. I've got Alexander Montague is going to come on in a few minutes here to talk to us about privacy laws here and in the UK and how that relates to how things go today with technology and Google and all that other good stuff. So maybe we can kind of move along. We missed you last week. Glad to have you back this week, and I was particularly interested in this question from last week because I am just such a huge Nintendo gaming fan. Link, Zelda, I love the whole series. I missed one of them when Nintendo the Nintendo 64 came out, but I've kept game playing with most of it all the way through, and I had no idea. So Zelda, though, it turns out, is not just a mythical made-up name. There's some reality to that.
No, when Shigeru Miyamoto, the famous Nintendo like scion of all early game design Legend of Zelda, he actually stole the name from Zelda Fitzgerald, the wife of novelist F. Scott Fitzgerald.
Fantastic. Zelda Fitzgerald. And so was there a backstory? Was there some connection, or was it just that he just had a fascination with F. Scott Fitzgerald?
Well, he wanted to get a namesake of a famous and beautiful woman that caused trouble, which was definitely Zelda Fitzgerald. She was sort of the Miley Cyrus or the Kim Kardashian of her time. She was completely out of control, wife of a famous novelist, raging alcoholic, tons of nervous breakdowns. In fact, she has a lot of namesakes, like the Eagles song, Witchy Woman, is about her. You know, Tennessee Williams has written plays about her. Woody Allen has featured her in two different films as a namesake or an inspiration for a crazy, beautiful woman. And it goes all the way down to there's a wild turkey that lives in Battery Park in Manhattan. It's named Zelda because more often than not, when Zelda would have a nervous breakdown and wander out of her Manhattan apartment, she would end up in Battery Park. So there's a tradition of naming wildlife that sort of live in are insane in Battery Park in Manhattan, Zelda. So there's the legend of Zelda isn't just a video game. There is a legend of the woman named Zelda Fitzgerald just being famous, beautiful, and crazy.
I like it. I never made that connection in all my years of playing the game. I've read much of F. Scott Fitzgerald. I know a lot of this backstory about his wife Zelda, and I never equated the two. That's awesome. That if I ever go back and play any of the Zelda and Link to the Past and the other games, I'll have to keep that in mind.
Well, just as an aside, the actual gameplay of Legend of Zelda, it was actually, Miyamoto was actually trying to create a sandbox game, because he said he wanted the experience to be like when he was wandering the gardens in his native Japan, where like you would turn a corner and suddenly be this giant promenade of you know, arches and gardens and whatnot. You just never know what you're going to find around the corner. And if you remember playing the original mm-hmm. Legend of Zelda from 1986, that's exactly what happens. If you go through a door and, oh crap, there's a giant monster here, or oh wow, this goes on forever, or it's not safe to go alone, take this.
Yep.
It's something new around every corner. And he said that's what it's like wandering through elaborate Japanese gardens. If at the end of it is a namesake of F. Scott Fitzgerald's Crazy Wife.
Excellent. Oh, man. And that is one place that I have never been. I would love to get to someday is to Japan or anywhere really in Asia. I think would be fascinating to get and an experience. And maybe, and now I find it will perhaps add a new flavor or color to my computer gaming addiction as well.
Well, and now you can just pretend that Link is actually this F. Scott Fitzgerald cosplaying in Japan at a convention.
now that's a movie I want to see. That's an alternate history I think we need to write up. So Jay, what should we be thinking about for next week? Or at least I should say, what should Customer Jones be working on for next week? She did send the correct answer in as well this week, which people can always do to techtalk@wrlr.fm or to facebook.com/techtalkwrlr. All good places.
Well, it's been a pretty record-setting winter, what with the polar vortexes and whatnot. And down here in the South, we're finally getting a break. So I thought I'd keep us all in misery by discussing really extreme winters. So Neptune is known for having the coldest average temperature of any planet in the solar system, but it doesn't have the harshest relative winter. Another planet in the solar system actually has the harshest winter in the fact that it's the season we would consider winter is so astronomically colder than the mean temperature of the planet. So the question is, what planet in the solar system has the coldest and worst relative winter?
That's a great question. Now, and if it's considered a winter, it has to be then that it actually rotates through so that the different that's a great question.
I'll give you a hint. It's not Mercury for two reasons. One, Mercury is always hot. Mm-hmm. And two, Mercury doesn't really have seasons because its day is longer than its year.
Exactly. That's what I was trying to do was sort of figure out if I could exclude Mercury from the running. So that does help. That's a good one. And yes, and hopefully once we discuss that next week, we'll feel a little bit better about about our own winters. I don't know. This one has been rough. We got our couple of days of beautiful 50-degree temps, which was just long enough to melt everything so that it could refreeze back into giant sheets and blocks of ice. So yeah, we're...
I know exactly what you mean. So we got up into the 70s here, and it's in the 50s now, but they keep saying, end of the week, back into the 20s. It's like, no, we're finally out. You can't drag us back in.
No. You're getting back in the mix, just like the rest of us. At least for you guys, it'll have melted long enough that hopefully there won't be a ton of standing water laying around to turn back into ice. Well, Jay, I'm going to let you run. I've got to bring on our guest here. We will talk again soon, though, as well, and send Dave a couple of notes and texts, and he's on Facebook again now, and make sure that 70% turns into a 90, 95, or 100%. We can get the whole bunch of stuff.
Well, I can't list you guys as featured guests until I know who the guests are going to be.
I see.
See, well, Dave?
Are there going to be girls wearing sexy costumes?
There will be girls there, and there will be sexy costumes. How much those two overlap, you'll have to show up and see.
Yeah, is there a certain percentage of the girl that needs to be inside of the to say that she's wearing the sexy costume? we'll have to see. Oh, man. All right, Jay, I'm going to let you run. Thanks again so much. And again, conglomeration.info, I know, and jgarman.net for people that want to find out more about Jay and the things that you've got going on, too.
All right. Well, you guys have a good weekend and try not to freeze.
We will. You too. Take care, Jay.
Take care, Jay.
Bye. Jay Garman, always fantastic to have him on air with us. And I am going to jump right into giving a phone call here to our good friend Alexander Montague. And now he, of course, is out on the East Coast, where they've had their own level of issues with weather and storms and all that. Although I think they're kind of past the worst of it as well, hopefully.
Well, yeah, spring's only a few days away.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Theoretically.
Alex Montague.
Good morning. Mr. Montague, you are on the air on Tech Talk on WRLR 98.3 FM here in Illinois. Thank you so much for coming and joining us. And apologies, we're a couple of minutes, as I told you we probably would be. We're a couple of minutes later than I had hoped. It's great having you back on air with us. If people don't remember, you were on, I think it was close to a year ago, discussing your book and intellectual property and just a fantastic range of things. Today, though, we're hoping to maybe talk a little bit about privacy and privacy laws. Maybe if you want to give maybe just a quick couple second intro, though, to who you are and where people can find information about you, and then we'll jump into some good stuff.
Well, thank you so much for having me again. I'm delighted to be back. And I'm an intellectual property lawyer based in New York City. And as you said, you know, I had this book out last year, Intellectual Property, Money and Power in a New Era. Some of the things that I'll be discussing today with you on the show, you know, you could read about it at more length in my book, which you could find basically on our website, which is www.montaguelaw, and Montague does not have an E at the end, montaguelaw.com/book.
Mm.
But I am delighted that you would like to talk to me about privacy issues because, as you know, it's been very topical, and I think that there's been some degree, if not a great degree, of confusion around what this all means. What does privacy mean in today's world?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, things have changed so much. As you said, there's been a lot of discussion about it, certainly from the standpoint of how much right does the government have to intrude upon our privacy? How much right do private institutions have to intrude upon our privacy? And really, by definition, you know, what do we mean even when we say privacy?
Yeah, exactly. And you have to look at it exactly as you bring that up. You have to look at who is doing what to whom, right? So because when you have the situation where the government is collecting information, as indeed in the NSA case that's going up to the Supreme Court that's been in the media daily, where you know, the government is collecting these metadata on phone records on individuals, mm-hmm. The question here is, you know, do we want the government to be doing that? And who's going to decide that, right? Is the court's going to decide that under the Constitution? Is this something that is going to be legislated? So, and we're talking about ultimately the privacy of the individual as opposed vis-a-vis to the government.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Right? And the law here that's applicable really is the Fourth Amendment of the Constitution. Fourth Amendment, right, against unlawful seizures.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I was just going to say it's interesting too. You know, I hadn't thought about that. You're absolutely right. And that relates a lot to you know, our laws that are about privacy of communications. And those have changed dramatically over the last 50 years or so as our communications have changed. You know, it's no longer appropriate or lawful for the government, for example, to tap into your phone lines, which it used to be, because that was considered to be something that happened outside of the walls of your house. You know, clearly, this seems to be an evolving concern and an evolving issue. How is that continuing to adapt and change for that Fourth Amendment?
You know, This is the key issue that you're bringing up, and this theme runs through my book. This is why I wrote the book, because what I have said and argued is that the technology that we have. This is a revolutionary technology, and it is changing the way that we live our lives, that we do business with each other. And our laws have not caught up with that. Now, the primary area of the law that's becoming applicable to this is intellectual property. You know, property rights, which are becoming increasingly intangible, which is intellectual property. And privacy is a branch of that. So, you know, the issue that you raise is a question of what is the Fourth Amendment's application against the new technologies that we have in the world of the new technology.
Mm-hmm.
So let me tell you, for example, under the Fourth Amendment, the government needs to get a warrant to look at your files on the internet, correct? You need to do that.
Yep.
Now, let me pose this question. What if your files are stored on the cloud? And now the person, the entity that is storing these files is not even in the U.S. Let's say that it's based in the U.K. The servers are in the U.K. There is no Fourth Amendment in the U.K. So the Scotland Yard, which is the police in England, can obtain those without a warrant.
I did not realize that. I did not think about that. Yeah.
And share them with the Department of Justice or FBI or who have you.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, is that the same if the company is a U.S. company, but the some of the cloud storage equipment that they have is based and located in the UK. I mean, one of the benefits of a cloud storage solution and situation is that, of course, your information is dispersed across many, many platforms and many, many systems that are not geographically located in the same place. How does that impact
that,
too?
That situation, you see, again, you have to look at who the actors are, right? So you have the situation where the government is obtaining information on individuals. Then you have the situation where private institutions are collecting information on individuals, which is for a very different reason, right? Private institutions like Google and Facebook and the phone companies, they collect personal information for a very different reason than the government collects information. They collect information primarily for their marketing purposes, for making money, commercial purposes. And we have laws, various laws that regulate that, primarily in Europe. In the U.S., we don't have a uniform law that applies to the collection of personal information by private entities like Google and Facebook.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we have state by state. You know, California has a law, Massachusetts has a law. And then we have the situation where the government is collecting information through these entities. Mm-hmm. And those entities may resist it, may cooperate with the government. And so the situation you're raising is, okay, what if we have a situation like, let's say that your files are stored on the cloud with Google. And Google is a U.S. company, but somehow the servers are in the U.K. in this example. And can Scotland Yard obtain those without a warrant, without the Fourth Amendment? And my argument would probably be yes, they can, because Scotland Yard is not subject to the Fourth Amendment. It doesn't apply outside the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
So what we're saying here is that we have a technology that has unleashed globalization. And our laws have not caught up with that. Our laws are very much local, and they're also very slow, and they were made for a different time period. And we see this repeatedly over and over again. I don't know if you've seen this Aereo case as well that's going up, the broadcast of antennae movies.
Yes.
Yes. So this is another situation where we've got a technology that's allowing this company to take the shows, the TV shows, by putting antennae on top of the Empire State Building and broadcasting these. And so we have a big dispute that's being that's being argued under the copyright statute.
Yes.
Under copyright law. Now, copyright law comes down to us from 1709 in England. And it only applied to books. Okay? Copyright law initially as written gave a 14-year term of protection against copying of a book.
Yep. Yep.
Now, what we're trying to do is to say, okay, we're trying to apply that law to resolve a dispute between the movie, the studios, and this aerial company that's broadcasting streaming videos, right? Streaming their programs.
Yeah.
And this is the same thing that we're seeing with the Fourth Amendment, with the new technology, and we're also seeing it in other areas. I mean, another aspect of privacy is, you know, did you see this Kane West case with the coins?
Mm.
So, you know, these people went and created these coins that sort of compete with the Bitcoins.
Yes.
And they put the rapper's image on it.
Yes.
Coin, and he is very upset about that, and he has sent a demand letter saying that, you know, they're violating his privacy rights.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, is some of this, though, can we get past some of it by, you know, moving? I know we have this very, especially in the U.S., it seems, we have a very prescriptive sort of legal system where we need to or want to identify, each, tittle and dot of what an action could be. But moving away from that and saying, you know, maybe what we need to do is instead create language that allows us to establish reasonable expectations. And so, say if I engage with Google and I've got Gmail, and so I've got my mail requires a password, and in fact I've got mine set up where I've got double authentication, et cetera. I should have a reasonable expectation then that no one other than the people that must store the Gmail on their servers should have access to that without those passwords, regardless of where in the world it's stored. That's a cloud service that I've established as a holder for my intellectual property. Compared to, for example, posting something on a Facebook where I've said I want this to be a public thing that I'm stating and I'm putting information out there, that clearly I should not have that same reasonable expectation of privacy as I would with my password, double password protected mail account.
Yes, absolutely. And, information that you put, you would expect that information that you have behind password protection would be confidential and would remain private. But that is not the case. That is not the case, and certainly not the case internationally. For one, private is against whom? It is not going to be private as against various government agencies who are going to be able to obtain that information from the provider. And the next thing is, what about as against the provider itself?
Mm.
What uses can that provider make of your information? You know, let's even go with your name, your email address. Can they use that to market to you? Can they give it to their affiliates to market to you?
Mm. Yeah.
Right? These things, these questions have not been properly addressed or resolved, and I think we're going about it in sort of an ad hoc way.
Mm-hmm.
Right? We've got people who sort of have this expectation that everything that they have out there is going to be private and it's going to be confidential, but it's really not the case.
Mm-hmm.
And we're not looking at it in a global way. Instead, we're resolving it on a case-by-case basis.
Yeah,
I mean, there's an interesting case I wanted to tell you about in Spain that brings up a similar issue where this person has challenged Google and has said that when people do a Google search of his name, he should be invisible. He should be anonymous, that Google must not link to anything that's out there. And that is a constitutional right that he expects to have complete and utter privacy and confidentiality against being visible. online.
Huh.
And that's a case that's going to the European Court of Justice to be decided. So we'll see.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, even given the, you know, leaving the idea of whether that's a reasonable request or not to the side, the practicality of it, given the scope of Google, I think is... A little questionable. You know, I mentioned actually right before you came on, I was mentioning that you actually you have a namesake, an Alexander Montague who has a very colorful background and past, and that if people search on your name without understanding that or without knowing that, they could confuse the two, and this topic here brings that question up. You know, should you have the right to say that either that your name does not show up at all, or to even to influence how searches come up with your name to make sure that that confusion is reduced?
Yes, exactly. And, you know, the other question that comes up is who should make these decisions?
Mm-hmm.
Should the courts make these decisions? Should the legislature make these decisions?
Mm-hmm.
Should there be international treaties on this? I mean, my view is that as these things are international and they don't stop at anyone's borders, there should be a big effort right now mm-hmm. to hammer these out and have a global effort mm-hmm. to try to come up with some answers to some of these questions. They're really fundamental, and they go beyond just a single person's issue. Every single one of the issues that you brought up today requires an international solution that is beyond the scope of any one court, including the Supreme Court or the European Court of Justice. Whether or not you are entitled to anonymity on the internet,
mm-hmm.
whether or not governments should be entitled to access certain information that we would consider private without warrants, whether or not private entities should be able to use personal information for commercial gain, whether or not celebrities like Kanye West or others have a right to completely control the use of their image and their name on the internet. Well, in connection with Bitcoin.
And this really does, you know, and when we first started talking about it, I was thinking, how is this connected to property laws? But I'm starting to really see it now, I think, is that what's happening is that our definition of property is expanding from the things that we create and the content that we have or produce to also include the records of our actions and the extent of usage of services and our image of ourselves and so on. It seems like it's this never ending whirlpool of, or not whirlpool, but ripple effect throughout us as our ability to impact things around us expands and our geography expands.
The concept of property and ownership has completely morphed. And if you don't mind, I'll try to situate us this in a sort of a little bit of a historical perspective.
Yeah.
You know, there was a time when we lived in an agrarian world, right? And everything was agriculture and land was paramount. And in those days, the most important laws that we had to do with land. You know, in medieval England, which we don't think about anymore, but that's where our laws came from.
Mm-hmm.
To the extent we think of a law back then, we might think of Magna Carta. Magna Carta was not an important statute for the people of the time. There was another statute called Quia Iam Torres. It was the most important law of the time. Why? Because it affected land. Its ownership, its disposition, its inheritance. Right. Whoever owned land had money and access to armies. They could raise armies.
Mm.
And that was the case for centuries. And that law was the most important law until the Industrial Revolution came along. But what was the Industrial Revolution? It was a new technology. And what happened as a result of the Industrial Revolution was that commerce, trading, eclipsed land as the primary commodity of the economy, Industry mm-hmm. replaced land. And so commercial law became the dominant force of our economy, and eclipsed land law. And now what we're having is that the new technology that we have is eclipsing commercial law. Mm. So it's a new property right. It's what we call intellectual property, because everything of value today is becoming intangible. Mm-hmm. Think of the property rights today that are the most valuable. What are they? They're Microsoft Windows. They're Google searches. They are information providers. They are high-speed trading systems.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And with it comes property rights like your name, as a celebrity name. These things have eclipsed. I mean, land, yes, sure, it's important. But, commerce, yes, tables and chairs and things like that. Yes, they're important. But what we're talking about today is intellectual property, is intangible property. That has become paramount.
Mm-hmm.
And its ownership and its disposition and its transfer are what's driving our economy on a global scale.
Yep.
But our laws have not caught up with this.
Yeah, and I think more than just our laws. I mean, really, I think our perceptions have not caught up with what the ramifications of that are. You know, we talked a little bit about the idea of these companies that we interact with and that we act with keeping our information and then using that and considering that a breach of privacy. But even just a few years ago, that would not have been so. No one questioned when Sears, for example, would keep track of how many of their coupons were used and how many times they sent a mailer out that it actually resulted in a sale. Yet today, now, because of the speed and the depth and the breadth of the information that we can collect and that we can correlate to, all of a sudden people realize that this information can be disaggregated to the point that they'll know exactly what I personally am doing and what I personally am most likely to want to do, and they're going to target their marketing at me. And now that's considered for some reason a breach of privacy, even though, like I said, 5, 10, 20 years ago, nothing of the sort would have even occurred to people.
Absolutely. And underlying that is that two things. This has become a lot more valuable,
mm-hmm.
right? Personal information has become a lot more valuable. If you stop and think about how these companies make money, right? Google's a good example. A few years ago, 3 years ago, there was a big case against Google in Europe. When you go onto Google, let's say, and you type in Armani as a search, mm-hmm. you'll see on the right and on the top ads, right? Paid for ads.
Yep.
Now, those ads may have something to do with Armani, may not have something to do with Armani. And this practice was challenged in France by LVMH, which owns Louis Vuitton and other properties, and said that, Google is using their name, their trademark, without their consent.
Mm.
And it's a violation of their rights, and Google should be stopped from doing it. Now, in the case, it turns out that something like 90% of Google's revenues come from these paid-for ads.
Yeah.
90% of Google's revenues come from these paid-for ads. Of course it's becoming a big issue. One of the most valuable companies in the world, if not the most valuable company in the world, its profit center is using these trademarks, using names, other entities' names.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's
becoming a very big issue. And so with it are concerns about who owns what name.
Yeah.
And who controls it? So, and, it brings us back to the beginning of our conversation is when we think about issues of privacy, we have to think about who's doing what. When Google is using someone else's name, that's one thing, or collecting information or transmitting information, that's one thing. When the government is doing it, it's obviously for a very different reason.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And the government is collecting that information and has much broader powers to do it. So we have to look at these things we have to look at these things on a case-by-case basis and see what our rights are. But my view is that we need a much more universal and global approach to these issues because of the new technology that is changing every day.
Yeah. Yeah.
As a citizen, what can we do? Is there a lobbying group that we can join, or can we offer support? Can we write our congressman? What can we do?
I mean, you know, it's an interesting question because I think that we're so far from that. I mean, individuals and consumers are so far removed from this. You know, this requires cooperation at the international level. And I don't know that we're not anywhere near that. I mean, you know, it really took World War I to set up the League of Nations and the United Nations, and so that people wouldn't fight over those things like they used to in the 19th century,
mm-hmm.
right? So that, you know, we came to terms on the ownership, individual ownership of the sea, you know, how far it goes out and who owns what. We need similar things in this area, and I just don't see it.
Yeah, Do you think that is it just not resolvable? Is this something that is not, I mean, at least not in the way that we're discussing and attempting to approach it now, that really what is going to happen is we'll have to remove some of the, desire or attempt to apply legal strictures to our definitions of privacy and instead just say, look, you don't have reasonable expectation of privacy when you are communicating over these carriers, and that you still should certainly have copyright and some other things when it comes to real property, but when it comes to these intellectual properties, when it comes to these softer, and I shouldn't use the term real, but when it comes to these more nebulous property concepts, that we just have to remove some of our reasonable expectation of privacy on them.
I would say that the issue is that these cases are being decided in the courts, and it's taking several years to decide them, and by that time the technology has morphed,
mm-hmm.
and the problem is that we're using these old laws to apply to the new technology, and by the time we have a court decision on one piece of technology, the reality is that we're dealing with something completely different and we need a new case.
Mm-hmm.
And this, we're seeing this across the board, not just in terms of the concept of privacy. Okay, so we're going to have this case, national, the NSA case, resolved hopefully by the Supreme Court. But, we had two conflicting decisions at various courts of appeals on that, depending on how they're viewing the technology. But we're seeing it, for example, on the distribution of music and movies on the Internet.
Yeah.
Look, for the last 12 years, we've had court cases on this. You know, there's a case between Viacom and YouTube that's been going on for the last 5 years,
mm-hmm.
that hasn't been resolved yet. And obviously, something's not working. The court cases are not addressing the fundamental issues that we're dealing with.
Mm-hmm.
The court cases resolve the one dispute. And by the time the one dispute is resolved, it's outdated. Technology that was the subject of that dispute is outdated.
Well, and that's why the Aereo case that you brought up earlier is so perfect of an example of that, is that there, what they're doing is they're really making a distinction between, in a way that other cases have not, a distinction between the content that they're distributing and the distribution of it and the service of distributing it and storing it. They've even gone so far as to say each individual who signs up for their service has space on a server that is storing this content, so you can't use your standard sort of licensing laws and other things to go against them. But of course, because this is so different from the way things have been handled in the past, it's causing a great uproar.
Yes, and you know, it's backwards. So what's going on in area codes is they're coming under copyright law, which uses the word public performance.
Mm-hmm.
Hmm? Right?
Yeah.
You can't make a public performance. And so Aereo is saying, we're not making a public performance. And the studios are saying, yes, you are making a public performance. So now everyone is trying to contort this technology into the definition of a public performance. But yes, that's why you will see in all of these cases, everyone is sort of, it's really an Alice in Wonderland world.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because this is a new technology. The distribution, the streaming of these programs, whether or not that's a public performance or not, let's step back and say, do we want this?
Yeah.
Right? It's not the domain of the courts to decide whether we want this. This is the domain of the people. We are the domain of the rule of we the people. Do we want to have Aereos, or do we not want to have Aereos? Do we want to have YouTubes, or do we not want to have YouTubes?
Yeah. And that, unfortunately,
so we need laws to decide that. We don't need a court to tell us whether it's a public performance or not. They will not be able to tell us that one way or another. They may come out one way or another.
Mm-hmm.
But ultimately, it's not going to make any sense because that law was not designed for this particular dispute.
Yeah, and by the time...
And we don't need a court to tell us that we're out of time either.
Yes, I know. I was just going to say, unfortunately, and we're getting to a point here where the discussion is getting extremely interesting. But as you can sense, I think, you know, it's difficult to unravel the strings. And I'm going to make a quick plug for your book, Alex, is that it's very approachable. It's not written in such a way that people that don't have a deep, you know, understanding of the legal system and so on cannot read it and gain a lot of really valuable and informative viewpoints and perspectives on what is happening today, not just nationally, but internationally with our privacy and intellectual property laws. Again, the name of the book, Alex, if you could remind me, and the website, and then I'm going to have to bring us out.
Sure. The name of the book is Intellectual Property, Money and Power in a New Era. And you can find it on our website, which is montagulaw.com/book.
Excellent. Excellent. And I'm so sorry to have to do this and bring us to a close. We could go on for another hour easily just on this topic alone. Thank you so much for your time and expertise coming on the show. And I know that you and I will speak again shortly as well.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a great pleasure as always.
Thank you. Thank you. Take care. Have a great weekend.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Alexander Montague. Absolutely. Absolutely. He's just, as I said, just has such a depth of knowledge and a great perspective on this stuff. It's wonderful. I know for a fact we will have him on again. And Dave, I'm going to let you go right now too. We'll have you on again as well. And I'm going to keep elbowing you to come out down to Louisville for the conglomeration convention as well. I'm not even going to play any podcast only songs of the week. I'm just going to take us out. I'm going to do some spots and stuff like that. And Rob Rigel from Rob Shot First is going to be on in just a minute talking science and good stuff like that. So thanks, Dave.
Have
a great weekend. Take care.
Yeah, bye.
Bye. All right, that was Dave Sparky Saganaki, and Rob is ready to roll here. So you know what I'm going to do? Like I said, I've got some ideas, I've got some spots to go, and I am out of here. You've been listening to Tech Talk on WRLR 98.3 LP FM in Round Lake Heights, Illinois. Have a great weekend, everyone.